technically savvy than I am. Okay, take two.
They shot him in the back, 'cause it's a crime to be black. And don't you act surprised when it gets vandalized.
The White Privilege Podcast. I'm your host, Very White Guy. As always, I'm joined by my co-host in angry vicissitude, Drumbeats for Peace. Thank you for joining us. And our guest this week is Amy Steven. And Amy, we talked a whole bit, and I didn't even get to know much about you. So I want to hear a little bit more maybe about what you're willing to share in terms of your background. But I'll just let everyone know, again, this is the White Privilege Podcast. You can find us at Interracial John. That's J-A-W-N. You can find us on Stitcher and iTunes. Again, just search Interracial John, J-A-W-N, or I-R-J, White Privilege. And in this episode, we're going to be talking about supremacy in general, criminal justice system, including our drug policy, judicial system, our approach to policing, dog whistles, how they've stymied us, in fact, I would say anti-racist, even liberals' ability to talk about race, and hopefully some useful tips on how to speak out about race and racism. And Amy, you brought some wonderful examples of institutional and other forms of racism. But if you would, Amy, just maybe tell us a little bit about yourself or what you're willing to share.
Okay. Hey, first, thanks for having me on. I mentioned before to the both of you that I got so much out of listening to your podcast. It is since August 9th and seeing what has happened, it's been amazing to find other white people who share my outrage and confusion of what's going on with people in Ferguson, with black people in Ferguson. I'm a geek. I'm not a sociologist. I'm not an expert in racism. I'm a geek, and I'm a grandmother. I have two grandkids that are 2 and 1 years old, and they mean everything to me. I have two kids. I've been in technology for about 30 years now. Worked at the Lincoln Telephone Company, and then at the University of Nebraska for years, and now I'm an open source developer. And I just I follow some black feminists on Twitter, which I strongly recommend. Feminisa Jones, in particular.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah, she's an amazing woman. And so I came across this conversation and started to watch what was happening in Ferguson, and really felt the need to be a witness to this violence going on, and became more and more concerned about the people there. So that's how I got involved. At some point, people who are following me on Twitter are going to see me talking about PHP and MySQL, and they're going to be very confused. But that's what I typically talk about.
Very good.
They'll be like, hey, why am I following her?
Now, what is she talking about? So I might bring some of you along on the web development
sure.
road.
You know, so. I don't know if maybe you were, I don't know if we were connected at this time, but a while back I learned about a open source tool that allows you to manage a community block list. And I'm thinking it would be great if we could get all the leaders down in Ferguson, you know, DeRay, Netta, Shorty Doo-Wop, you know, Music Over People, Basm, all those guys, get all of them to give us a CSV, like an export of people they've blocked. And then we could have a Ferguson block list. So maybe your skill set in the open source, I stayed away from it because it is open source and it's probably a little bit of coding, but I think it's just managing it on the front end and then allowing people to have access to it on the back end and then updating it regularly. So maybe we can talk about that afterwards. But I'm thrilled to connect with you in that regard. And Drumbeats, do you have anything you want to add since last week? How you doing? We haven't spoken a bit.
Oh, no, very good. It was another frustrating week. It's just one rolls right into another. It's just the frustrating and heinous and non-sympathetic, non-empathetic, non-caring behavior continues. And
I hear
you just try to rise above it and keep fighting and keep moving forward and trying to teach. So that's why we're here. So
good,
let's keep trying to teach and and learn too. You know, yeah. I mean, I have a lot to learn as well. I'm just, like, as I said before, recently awake. Not recently awake as a man who's disgusted, but recently awake as an activist who's ready to let people learn and grow and take on that disgust and hope for change.
Yeah, and I think all three of us are sort of the same. We, you know, we're awake to a degree, but not. My personal view is I'm aggressively anti-racist, and that's August 9th forward. And and so it's a good segue. You said this last week's been really crappy, and specifically, I know there was the Piers Morgan telling black folk or people of color they can't or shouldn't use the N-word. There was the Jane Nixon's.
That one bothered me some, and I wasn't impressed with that one at all. And DeRay really was bothered by that one. He went on for a while on that, but. I was much more had much more difficulty with the press conference.
So did I, sir.
Governor Nixon put on with his people. That was just systematic, once again, systemic hatred, and just that. I tweeted that I don't think I'm having a hard time deciphering what planet he's on.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
some of the things that are said there, you're just. You don't even. They don't even hear themselves.
Well,
they don't even hear that.
No, they don't.
And I'll tell you why. It's a dog whistle.
Talking down to a segment of the population, just and not only a segment of the population, but one that he's supposed to be coveting, has a segment that has always voted for him. And just, I mean, here's a guy in the 1990s, and you won't hear this on mainstream media at all. You won't hear anybody talk about it. CNN won't say it. Even MSNBC, who's supposed to be on the side of the left, will never say it, and certainly Fox on the right will never say it. This is a guy in the 1990s when he was Attorney General in Nixon who wanted to resegregate the schools. I mean, this is
really?
The background of this guy. This is the this is the headspace that this guy is in. That, I mean, he obviously, generally, when... there's something like this. There's always this dog whistle about what his reason for is that masks the true reason. I mean, it's never 100% overt. He said it was a cost basis analysis, but anybody's on the side of humanity is never going to care about cost there. He's not going to work out how many additional dollars will be spent if the schools are segregated. It's just such a no-brainer. You sacrifice somewhere else. So this is this guy's background, and we're 20 years later, and he's the exact same man. And the wolf in sheep's clothing, I would like to say, that would be a compliment to him if he were a wolf in sheep's clothing. Because this guy's just a wolf.
Yeah.
He's not even wearing sheep's clothing.
When we talked about that, Amy, that at least for me, the wake-up call was the dog whistle of Mike Brown's the surveillance video being released that had no bearing and relevance. It was so obvious. But so you mentioned dog whistles. We had a whole episode on the interracial John where my wife and I, Leslie Mack, talked about dog whistles. I've got a couple different people that are listening to this or new to that term. I just want to go ahead and play a little definition that's from Ian Hanny Lopez, and he's written a book, Dog Whistle Politics, and I really recommend it. It's terrific.
Definitely.
But he has a few videos that we'll post in the footer links with the... with this podcast. Let's go ahead and play just the definition real quick.
Dog whistle politics doesn't come out of some desire to hurt minorities. It comes out of a desire to win votes. It's racism as a strategy. It's cold, it's calculating, it's considered. It's the decision to achieve one's own ends, here winning votes, by stirring racial animosity.
And so I think that was, like you said, all these things that are happening are dog whistles of some sort. And even whether you think it's a dog whistle, it's stirring racial animosity. And they're deliberate. It's intentional. And this is the same guy, Governor Nixon, that a couple months ago came on the TV and said, we need to focus on Anglo-American justice, right? Like wrote a speech referencing Anglo-American justice.
That's amazing.
It's mind-boggling. So I think that what I want to talk about, I want to get your opinion, but this sort of evolution of racism, right, is no longer this overt sort of, you know, epithets. So on the one hand, the dog whistle part, we can, you know, hey, we're not really being racial. We're talking about welfare queens, or we're talking about, you know, the takers and makers, whatever the rhetoric or the narrative is. But then this other bit, they're saying, hey, it's race. You know, we're getting you, we're zinging you with some fear about race. But for us, for, you know, middle of the road white folk like me, you, Amy, Drumbeats, you're Canadian, so not. But it's hurting us just as much. The ability to leverage that race, you know, whistle is winning elections. Politicians are leveraging it on both sides. Bill Clinton did it with tough on crime. We've got, you know, Romney talking about 47% of the country doesn't matter. So, you know, what are your thoughts, Amy, in terms of, I sometimes I want to, for white folk, and I hate to say it this way, but I get kind of, I'm angry, I'm agitated, I'm dialed to 11 like Drumbeats. But there are, you know, sometimes white folk that need to hear things in a certain way before they're really going to kind of wake up. And you and I talked a little bit about that, where you might think differently. But do you think a financial, you know, is that the way to go? Like, hey, listen.
Well, I think it's important for people to know. I think I shared a link with you that said 85 people in the world have as much wealth as 50%, you know, of the lowest wealth-owning people in the world. So we are seeing a world, whether you like it or not, where the middle class is falling out, poverty is growing, and a very small number of people, like Romney, own a very large portion of wealth. And so they're controlling this wealth. Means that they're controlling elections, you know, even before we get up to the polls and we say A or B, they've decided who those people are. Yeah. And we need to be aware that really I'm new to dog whistle politics, and from what you've shared with me, some really good videos, it reinforces some of the thoughts I've had that we're encouraging people to sell each other out, right? Mm. White people sell out black people, and we think we're somehow immune. But as this income divide and this wealth divide increases, we all become more vulnerable. Now, I happen to believe that you cannot sell people on justice, right? You either buy into the concept that we're only as safe as if everyone has the same, you know, rules, and that makes us all more safe. And I don't really believe you can sell people on this threat that they'll be next if they don't understand justice. But that's why it's working. Is people believe somehow they have some kind of an advantage to selling others out. You know, and so they look the other way, and this has been going on for a long time, and just kind of built into our culture. And it's something we don't even see today. Most people aren't even awoke to it.
Yeah.
You know, as Drum was saying, that, you know, you have to be made aware of these things, and once you see it, you can't unsee it.
And I want to make sure people really understood, because you went through quickly. 85 people. That's less than 100 people. 85 humans own as much wealth as 3.5 billion of the planet's poorest.
Correct.
That's staggering.
And I think
that's unfathomable.
Decreasing. I think it's 67 now. It's an amazingly small amount of people. So for me, when I saw the militarization of Ferguson, I was unable to sleep, because I understand a small number of people. We've been building up, you know, the militarization of our cities. And look at the power they have, and who's controlling this, and how are they controlling what these police do? So everyone should be concerned about it. It should be enough to know that the color of our skin shouldn't make any difference. But if that's not enough for you, if it has to be personal, understand you could be next.
And let's hear from you, Drumbeats. Do you think that this approach of saying, hey, this is costing all of us our elections, it's costing, we're pawns, that going this, you know, this approach, do you think that's a way to wake people up, or is it just, if they're not seeing it, they're not seeing it?
Well, I think what the part that that you said there that I'm going to gravitate to is the pawns part. I have an activist friend who's been doing it for 30 years, and she speaks from a very, very wise place. And she'll speak in terms of the small victories that you make, and you try to make them larger victories. But there are things that are hard to hear, but they're big truths. And that we are pawns is certainly one of the truths. That it's a money-making machine for sure, and that there's nothing else that matters politically and through business. And any way to create more financial gains, they'll be done. and there'll never be a concern for the environment or the concern for equality or justice, as Amy was saying. That's just never going to get on the plate. And another point she wanted to make that I thought was just excellent, too, and it was hard to hear, is that there is absolutely no way that you can bring, and as much as this is hard to hear because some people are angry and some people want to lash out and they want to fight and they want to raise a fist or throw a bottle or shoot a gun, she said there is absolutely no way when you're looking at a populace that's already even on your best behavior judging you, that if you go down to your base behavior, that you can ever win this battle. And as much as it's hard for some people to hear that would like to throw a bottle to be violent, the only way that if Ferguson goes as bad as everybody thinks it's going to go, the only way that you gain any sympathy on the world stage or that you can change the government, change politics, change business, change the world, is by being civilly disobedient, by standing in front of that oppression and doing nothing but being peacefully in front of it. And as difficult as that sounds for some people, it is the only way that if the world, the better world, and we hope it's a larger segment than we're seeing in Ferguson in the United States right now, and I think it is, because I did something last night, and it was, this will not, violence will not be tolerated. It was this hashtag that I started that got amazing, amazing response. And it was basically suggesting violence will not be tolerated. And then we looked at all of the violence in the last 90 days, and all you could see in picture after picture, photo after photo, was no one being violent at all from the protester side. And it was troll-free, which is phenomenal. There was just no trolls for it because nobody could find any violence from the protesters who have been behaving miraculously. The highest regard for them that have stuck so strongly to exactly what they've wanted to say and do and be proud of, and they've done it. And there have only been outside elements every once in a while that have been at all violent, but even the exchanges that they said were violent, like there were no rocks, for instance, when the cops said there were.
Sure, they had one bottle of beer.
There was no tear gas ever thrown when they said they were. So the civil disobedience that they've done is the only way to find success. Because on the world stage, when the leaders of the world say to America, we could see no reason for any of that behavior. We could see no reason for 1,000 troops. We could see no reason for tanks. We could see no reason for Apache helicopters. It has to look like that. It has to the world, especially the racist world, or that person on the fence world. It has to look like there's nothing there but aggressive cops.
Well, and I'll say this, and I'm not disagreeing with your that opinion.
That's not actually my opinion. That's the opinion of somebody that's been an activist for 30 years and has been in the trenches.
Well, and this is just me personally. I perhaps tack a little bit. I'm overly sensitive. I'm married to a woman of color, so I'm very attuned and acute to, you know, I'm not saying that's the only way. I agree that being nonviolent shows.
Let me interject because I know what you're trying to get in there, and I'm going to say it before you.
Okay.
I'm going to say it before you, and I've said it on Twitter 100 times. If it does get violent, if there are difficulties like that, there's no one to blame but the government. There's no one to blame but Jay Nixon. There's nobody to blame but Bob McCulloch. There's nobody to blame but Jay Rorta.
Sure.
They are to blame. The protesters are not to blame at all. If it happens, I pass no judgment.
Well, it's
all on them.
I was going to say something different. I was going to say, and this is just, and I don't think that you're saying this, but I think that sometimes the message of, you know, especially from I'm very sensitive to, as a white person, saying anything to the leaders and protesters and people of Ferguson. I'm not there. I'm not, you know, of that community. I can't possibly. Well, and I don't know maybe I haven't, you know, I don't know what everyone
in DeRay. No, you can see in DeRay, their stance is very much civil disobedience. They expect that they will conduct no amount of violence themselves. They are not for that at all.
I'm glad to hear that. I want to be cognizant of not coming off as the sort of respectability politics. You have to act a certain way or we're not going to stop killing you.
No,
you know
I'm
what
not
mean?
Suggesting that at all. And that's why I wanted to step in front of what you were going to say. I'm not saying that at all. I'm not putting my judgment on anything.
I never thought you would.
that someone's been in the trenches 30 years, and this is historically what has worked better. Mm-hmm. It is not a judgment from a black to a white or a white to a black. It has no color to it. It has historically been what any protest has looked like, whether it be for fracking, whether it be for environmental concerns, anything, anything. Well, this debate that I'm saying right now, it has no color. It has no color, I promise you that.
And Amy, you had a comment?
First of all, I'm not so sure I agree with that.
Which part?
Just to kind of backpedal my own experiences back, and I'm not a 30-year expert. I don't study civil rights. I cannot, claim to be an expert on this, but I'm going to backpedal myself and my own white ass to August 9th and say, you know, I did say, violence is bad. You know, everybody be peaceful like you are. Make sure you're behaving. And the thing is, the message, and this is, you know, that I was doing wrong as a white person was kind of suggesting that black people are going to be violent, when the reality of the matter is we haven't seen any of this, just like you're saying, Drums. And what I saw the governor doing that was so disconcerting to me was when he said, you know, the world is watching. We will not tolerate any violence. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you're right. And you guys are the ones who've been violent. We need to keep that message, the one that's being said, because we haven't seen violence from the other side. Mm. And I completely trust the Ferguson protesters to be making the right moves. And I don't know that sometimes violence isn't the right answer, because if I have to look at a government that will not listen to its people, that's militarized, that's holding people down, that there is no First Amendment rights, no freedom to speech, you know, no freedom at all, then violence is the answer. You know, and I'm not saying what they should do or not do in Ferguson, but I stand in solidarity with them, and I trust
well
them.
Said.
And to make the right decision.
And I would add to that.
Don't get me wrong. I stand in solidarity.
Oh, we know you do. We know you do.
Anything that happens on that side, that's what
absolutely.
I'm trying to and I guess, say. I'm only saying that historically what has worked better. That's all I'm saying.
And
I'm not putting a color to it. And I know what you're thinking. You're
no,
saying,
no, no, no.
If somebody says they don't want to put a color to that, they're basically putting a color
I'll give it.
That dog whistle, I don't see color.
I've got a perfect way to state it.
That.
I've got a perfect way to state it, John.
Historically, that's the better way to go.
I don't even know if that's true, is what I'm saying.
Oh, no. Really?
I mean, when you look at the Watts riots, when you look at the L.A. riots, how can we say that those acts of violence did not contribute to change? When we look at the revolution of 1776, you know what I mean?
Well, let's also look at Montgomery, Alabama.
When we look at civil war, mm-hmm. you know, and when we see the Emancipation Proclamation, you know what I mean? How can we say violence doesn't contribute? We are a violent people as white people. We really have no room to speak on this almost when it comes to what they decide they need to do, because I just stand in solidarity with them, as do all of us.
Mm-hmm, definitely, 100%.
100%.
And as I said, whatever way it shakes down,
yes, whatever way
I'm 100% behind the community. 100%.
And I agree completely with what you said. I will stand and shake my head if it comes to that, because it didn't need to. And I hear you saying just that.
Well, I want to make sure we keep the episode moving along. We got a lot to
yes.
get to, and I'll leave my last just comment on it. I feel like there's a fine line, and this is where I struggle sometimes, John Beats, when people say, you know, nonviolence is the best approach. There's some respectability there. There's there's some little bit of the tropes. There's a fine line between that and, boy, I wish they wouldn't have looted. Why do they have to burn their own neighborhood? You know what I mean? So there's, and I'm not saying you're there. I'm not at all. I just, for me personally, there's a line. There's a fine line between, and I had a lot of friends. I lost friends that, you know, boy, I just wish they wouldn't loot. Why'd they have to, you know, why'd they have to do that? And it's sort of like, well, that's the last resource of the oppressed.
It's
the voice of the oppressed.
Why did they loot? There's a really easy answer. There are a million reasons.
Well, I guess I don't even need to get into it. I'm saying that there's a fine line.
Nothing else worked. I mean, that's That's what I'm trying to say is...
Because nothing else works.
I have a kind of a dream scenario where you hope that it's going to go one way, and that there's this, that DeRay and his people and their plan is to be peacefully protesting there, and it goes that direction, and then all of this military might looks just stupid that it's there, because it's just ridiculous that it's there, and it's dumb that these idiots think it's necessary when all they've seen for 90 days is peaceful protesting one night after another. Perfect, unbelievable behavior, because I would be enraged. I don't know how they do it. They're so wonderful.
Except the problem is that looks ridiculous to the world.
And if it looks ridiculous to the world, we move forward.
I was at MSN looking at, and MSN, you know, it would have to be considered to be one of the most liberal mainstream media outlets we have. And I did it
by the wayside.
They've done a reasonable job, I think, of covering Ferguson in comparison to the other mainstream media outlets. And they had this poll, and I took it because it's like, oh, I need a little boost of encouragement, right? And the poll said, should Darren Wilson be tried? It's like, well, heck, that's a gimme, right?
Right, right.
We have
a trial. It's not even guilty. Just go to trial. Yeah.
Do we have enough that there's a question there that he should be tried, that it should be all out in the public? You don't want to hear the answer.
How low was it?
It was like 33% agreed. Mm. And I did this double and triple take to see really if my color was really yes.
So, Amy, like that 33% thought a trial should be?
Yes.
On the more liberal?
Correct.
Oh, my goodness.
So this is why, you know, the one thing I loved about you guys' program and listening to you guys and your enthusiasm and your passion is it's embarrassing to me.
It is to be this angry
about something that these people have lived with every day that has been invisible to me. And so with you guys, you know what I feel like. But I can't say that violence is off the table because of my white privilege. Because in my world, my son, if killed, would get a trial. My son isn't going, you know, he doesn't have that risk even when he goes out. I've never worried about him as a teen when he wore his pants low, when he, you know, experimented with marijuana, when he broke the laws, as white teens do. Boys will be boys, right? I never worried about that. But our world is so different that I have to say, you know, I'm standing in solidarity with you because I don't know. And it's a feeling of helplessness. You know, it's just
I don't know how. I don't know how we got to a place.
I don't know either.
Philosophically, where we read all the great people of the world through generations and centuries, and you know, whether it be Plato or MLK, and we somehow got to a place where, through all of our highest humanity, all of our growth, taking away all of that primitive nature, that violent nature, through advancements in a myriad of ways, society, how we ended up in a place where we asked ourselves, is one man better than another man? And somehow, collectively, we came away with the answer yes. How did we... Well, do that. How does society have learned?
Amy just hit it on the head.
Yeah.
Answer yes to that. It's beyond the pale.
I want to make two points. One, let's not forget, as you both said, 90 plus days, people have been in Ferguson out there every night protesting for the simple request that they have a trial. They're not asking for anything more. Let's have a trial.
They're not even saying guilty, not guilty.
So
they're just
Let's look at it.
The other comment, I've had this argument with my wife, and she sort of turned me on to this, and I really, a lot of what maybe you hear from me is literally directly attributed to her and her wonderful tutelage of my whiteness. And I had that same attitude, like, oh, I can't believe it, I can't believe it. And she looked me dead in the eye, and she goes, you know what?
Can't believe which part?
I just can't believe that we're here, that today, right. this is so, you know, fucked up and crazy. And the other day I called it the most diabolical, perverse social engineering act of the modern era. And I think in 100 years we'll look at it and think that. But here's what she said to me, and it was I save this to this day. She said, Drew, it's not a fucking surprise. It is the fruit of those seeds that were sown so many years ago. It is the only outcome when you start by saying that this group is superior, this group is inferior, three-fifths to Jim Crow, to FHA-sanctioned redlining, to everything that we talk about that's been oppressing people of color. It's all economic. It's the engine that runs capitalism. The very first item on Wall Street was slaves. When people talk about the Industrial Revolution, they're talking about cotton. I don't know if that was the first, but one of the first, you know, Wall Street commodities. It might have been the most valuable Wall Street commodity at the time was slaves. And again, we talk about this, you know, the Industrial Revolution, They're talking about cotton. They're talking about slavery, you know? And they don't say that. We whitewash everything, at least here in the United States. And it starts all the way back. We don't talk about genocide of indigenous peoples. We talk about manifest destiny and how the West was won. Well, that's kind of cute. Wow, what a wonderful way of saying that, you know? And we talked on a podcast a couple of weeks ago about the Annie Lennox did a cover of Strange Fruit, which is a song that Billie Holiday did. And Leslie really took and I encourage people to listen to that, an in-depth look as to what that song really, why she wrote it. And it disturbed the shit out of me. We're talking about a lynching of two boys, left them on a tree, took postcards and couldn't print the postcards fast enough. That shit was like 1930 whatever, you know. It's not that long ago, and it's all supremacy. It's maintaining that status quo, and we wanted to talk a little bit about, maybe that's a segue into different forms of how this supremacy is affecting us. And I think we had cultural, individual, and institutional, and I want to make sure we talk about individual for me just personally, because I felt I had some issues with my church on an individual that was being racist, no other way to put it. But I think the institutional ones where we all get it and we kind of see it and it's so obvious, like Amy said, once your eyes are open to it, it's like, holy shit, how do I not, have I been living under a rock? Did I have blinders on? So I just go through a couple and then I'll let each of you talk. We all know drug sentencing is inherently biased, that the crack versus powder cocaine sentencing has recently been reduced to 18-1. It was previously 100-1.
100-1.
And that's, you just can't look at that and say, wow, that's obviously inherently biased. There's judicial and prosecutorial discretion, right? When an individual goes to court, the judge decides, you know, a lot of things, what kind of bail, what kind of bond. The prosecutor decides a lot of things. And I'm fortunate here in New Jersey, my wife worked for LMNJ, the Legislative Ministries, and they effectively got bail reform. California did as well. And the bail reform specifically, in New Jersey, the Constitution stated that there was a requirement to have bail. You couldn't have a release on your own recognizance, but you had to have some form of bail. So what happened is the people we want to have locked up, the violent, maybe, you know, criminals that have an organized crime, they've got lots of money, they can get out no matter what the bail. The people that get caught up in a first-time offense and get a $1,500 bail and they can't get out on $1,500. They languished in jail without being convicted. This is someone who's been merely arrested. It's a debtor's prison for months and months and months. And you know what happens? After like 4 or 5 months, you've lost your job, you lost touch with the family. Yeah. The prosecutor, with his discretion or her discretion, comes in and says, you've been sitting in here on this bond and bail for issue for 6 months. We don't want to go to court. If you plead guilty, we'll let you out. And now they can't vote. They're a convicted felon, and they wore them out. They
lost their children.
Yeah, it's absolutely just deplorable. So you know, and we see it in now big cities. New York is the most recent one to now decriminalize possession of marijuana, and I think it's more because white kids are getting caught with it. But for the longest time, that was a conviction. You get arrested, taken into jail, and that has a dramatically different impact on a white kid versus a person of color. And the statistics show that stop and frisk in New York was like, I forget the numbers, but it was overwhelmingly people of color. Yet, their own evidence, they were more likely to find contraband on white people. Right?
Yeah.
So their own evidence.
The bottom line to that whole argument for me is that all colors use drugs at the same rate. and there's
yes,
no discrepancy between. Yet, since the war on drugs started, the prisons have been increased in inmates 700%, and they've been predominantly people of color. And then you would say to yourself, if they're predominantly drug offenses and they're equal usage between races, we've obviously got prejudice to have all of the prisons filled up by people of color. This type of thing goes on, on and on and on. I mean, even today, there was a 16-year-old African-American who got 23 years for killing a police dog. 23 years for a dog, and yet Darren Wilson remains free. I mean, if you want to sit on your ivory tower and call that not racism, you are just so blind to everything in the world. It's sickening. I'm sickened every day.
Yeah, there's a great book, Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, talking about mass incarceration and the profiteering off of you know, people of color in this very regard.
Yeah.
And when you read into it,
there are many organizations, and much too many organizations, that profit. And this is one of the big ways that Canada is different than the United States, and I think in some capacity a better nation for it, is there are so many avenues that one profits from. And just to digress for 10 seconds, one, of course, is Canada has long had medical care, and it's free for everyone. Every single citizen receives it, and it's taken off the wealthy's paycheck. I mean, it's very much a democratic process that's from the left side, of course, that treats that all are equal, and that someone who's financially stable and able will give back to the community, so the entire community at large can be better. And yet, in the United States, the system is profiting from. You profit from, so you make decisions based on money and how much you can make.
Yep.
And that is just inherently wrong, really. And the same thing, like you were saying, has happened in the institutions of penitentiaries. And again, in Canada, we were like, what? You make money off of that? That's crazy.
And you know how crazy it is.
You make money by putting people in prison.
And it's not a little bit of money. They have they've taken it to, people of color, black men, are the most imprisoned individuals, the most, incarcerated group of people on the planet.
And look at forfeiture. Forfeiture again is another thing that you look at. Civic forfeiture. They stop somebody at a traffic violation that's probably trumped up, and then a guy maybe says something lippy for 1 second, and again we have statistical evidence that once again it's African Americans that are targeted here. You're four times more likely to get searched as an African American stopped in traffic than a white person, and so then they find something, whatever it be, $1,000 cash, suddenly it's in their pockets. Civil forfeiture is just, it's ridiculous. And then we also know that everybody in Ferguson's been saying for years that police department has basically bankrolled itself and found itself to be wealthy on the backs of these trumped up fines that they give to citizens all the time. And recently, we can add to it, in the last 90 days, it's been bail money. So, I mean, they're finding these capacities to make money on the back of treating citizens terribly. This is a ridiculous system. Where did this ever come from? I mean, it just starts with hating. It's hateful right from the get-go. Never mind that, I keep putting on Twitter this cop beating the crap out of a 55-year-old woman on the side of the road. I mean, that's the heinous part that one sees individually, but you can see that heinous behavior just in the systemic things that are created from civil forfeiture to penitentiaries to health care. I mean, it's everywhere.
Right.
The desire to make money in America on the back end of elitist companies that control, as Amy said at the beginning of the show, all of the wealth, is destroying the middle class and the poor class, but especially the middle class, and nobody talks about that. And it's just ridiculous that Fox News lives in a world that the super elite tell the elite who are on the air to tell the middle class to be horrible to the poor people.
Yeah.
And they get away with it. And nobody sees how systemically stupid that is.
Well, there's actually a good cue. I'm not just having a movie, but Ian Hanley talks about hurting the middle class. And I don't know if you know this, Drumbeats, but those privatized institutions, incarceration places, they're in rural places, traditionally GOP you know, areas, and they count those individuals towards their electoral influence, but they cannot vote. So these incarcerated citizens are counted towards their, you know, population density and their electoral influence, but they systematically remove them from the voting population. Then the thing that I find most insidious, they build these. So they give their cronies, hey, here's a kickback, build this private, you know, this privatized institution. And, oh, by the way, the city of Philadelphia, we're going to promise you, like a hotel, we're going to guarantee you occupancy. You know what I mean? They literally guarantee 95%. Yeah. It's so twisted. Right. But so there's a great video that Ian Haney, a comment that Ian had, I want to play about the hurting the middle class.
I have to spend some time with his work. I saw that video you shared, and I've got his book coming, and I think he's got a lot of those little questions that I've had answered.
Yeah, I thought I knew a bit, but he's brilliant, and I wasn't brilliant, but he's really just as much as Ta-Nehisi Coates with the case of reparations in the Atlantic.
Right.
Took a very linear connect the dots approach to housing and wealth building and what we've done to people of color. Ian Haney Lopez does the same thing from Barry Goldwater in 1960 all the way up to Mitt Romney with how dog whistle politics have been used in modern strategic racism. But so here's his quote about the middle class. Let me play this real quick.
In fact, racism has adapted in a way that continues to damage minority communities. I think about mass incarceration. I think about mass deportation. I think about the conditions in many poor areas of our country, rural and urban. But also, and here's the important point, race has evolved in a way that has damaged the broad middle class in this country.
And specifically by allowing race to be injected into vote and policy, and he further ties using race as this dog whistle into a general attack on liberalism, an attack on big government, an attack of the social safety welfare net that you are talking about as being so wonderful in Canada, and we had in 1935 with the New Deal liberalism and FDR, and politicians on both sides of the fence ran, you know, on that ticket saying this is great, this is wonderful, right. And you could see post the Great Depression, the income inequity, it started to shift. We had the single greatest advance of the middle class post the New Deal liberalism straight through to the 1960s when they started to run on dog whistle politics and cut it down. But I want to make sure we get to, because Amy, you brought this up, and I thought it was, maybe, I don't know if we'll have the chance to, but you had referenced a TED Talk that was on a band called The Slants. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about it, because I found it relatively fascinating. And I love that you brought it in. And I think that it's good to point out that what we're talking about, white privilege, supremacy of whiteness, it, although manifests itself, you know, very obviously and painfully for individuals of color, specifically black Americans, it doesn't just stop there. Our supremacy is over anyone that's not white.
And it's, right, it's not just black people, it's any non-white person. Our systems are built up to hold them down. And in this particular case, I think you're going to share that TED Talk link.
Right. It's a bit long, yeah. So I won't play it, but it's I've got the link for the notes.
Right. Simon Tam is his name, I believe. And he has a TED Talk. His band's name is Slant. They're a group of Asian musicians. They're trying to trademark their name. And there's been 800 applications that have gone in front of the United States Trademark Commission to use the word Slant in some way. And his request is the only one that was denied. And the reason that they denied it is because they will not trademark derogatory terms. And so his was the only request that was denied. And the reason that they gave him was they are too Asian to use the word slant.
Crazy.
So every one of the members of the band are Asian people. And so that brought the whole racist kind of connotation of this word slant into it. And even though they're trying to reappropriate this name in a positive way, the United States government is standing in the way of them doing so. So they're currently kind of going through the federal courts trying to get consideration for, you know, the use of their band name, and to get the United States government to stand down on preventing them from protecting that. And that kind of fits into the N-word discussion with Piers Morgan.
Sure.
You know, this past week, where you've got a white person, you know, the white supremacist standing outside of a group of people, a group of marginalized people, where white people have come up with this term, the N-word, and made it a derogatory term and used it to kind of oppress this group, used it to oppress this group of people. And as soon as the group starts to destigmatize that negativity and kind of, you know, make embrace it for their own, to make it not disparaging, then white people are back saying, no, you cannot do that. You
know? It's crazy.
We've got to
you know what's even more amazing in that example is how hard-headed he became in the actual learning about it.
Yeah.
He just got deeper and deeper into his own soup.
He doubled down.
He couldn't open his eyes that maybe, you know, 300,000 people might be right. They're trying to make a point to him.
Right. And that's, you know, as white people, we need to remember, okay, as allies, sometimes we're going to be called down. Sometimes we're going to be told.
Yep.
And we might not understand. In fact, we probably won't understand at first. And the best thing to do is just shut up and listen.
I think, Amy, that one of the reasons we wanted you on the show for sure is through my 90 days or whatever experiencing this woken up world, I don't know if I've seen anyone that understands white privilege better than you. I feel like most of my examples that I've learned are through you, and definitely Piers Morgan is one, but can I bother you to maybe list some of the... Because that's what we're all about here is I mean, we've even called it white privilege because it is basically two white guys, and we bring on a certain guest, Charles Wade, last week, who's in Geneva now, and you this week. But you know, we've called it white privilege for a reason because we want to teach. If you could give us some, you know, we could kind of roundtable about some examples. I'll start it up. I just listed one that I put on Twitter, and I showed that fella at the St. Louis Rams or Cardinals, I can't remember which game it was, but he grabs the flag that's upside down from the African-American lady, and he grabs it thinking that it's his white privilege to just take that damn flag out of her hand. And in the end, it got much worse in terms of he was allowed to go free. And I believe one, if it wasn't her, but somebody else, got actually slugged. And that person was the, I think there were two African-Americans that were arrested in the end. And even though the aggression was clearly from the other side to the point where somebody decided it was their flag. But, I mean, there are a million more like that. And I think one of the reasons I have to do and put my white privilege on hold more than any other time is just shut up and listen. Just be humble.
Just shut up and
just
listen.
Learn
be humble,
that you may actually be told something and don't have this knee-jerk reaction that I'm going to just get my back up because nobody tells me anything. But just stand down, be humble, realize
that
you haven't been in those shoes your whole life. Get in those shoes, as I like to say, and see if you can't do learning for some change. Because to suggest that you know everything for in a scenario that
is white privilege.
Is right, exactly.
That's the white privilege.
Is white privilege.
Exactly. We don't want you using the N-word, and we don't want you using the slant word, even though you guys are actually trying to, you know, take the stigma, the negativity out of it, repurpose it for positive use. We still don't want that. You know, we've got to stop trying to tell everybody how to live. And I think I said the other day, one thing, if I could have one wish granted for everybody, it's just that if you're not in that group, whatever group it is, whether, you know, it's Asian people, whether it's black people, whether it's women, any kind of non-white male group that doesn't have all the power or nearly all the power in the world, understand you don't know what it's like
to
be a member of that group.
Yeah, I would like to make a point to that because I think it's exactly what you're talking about. And in terms that one that's real for me is yesterday, I woke up and Twitter was a little bit of a shitstorm around me and I didn't know what was going on. And somebody mentioned the we can't say the R word. My instinctive response to that was, well, come on, we're trying to teach about racism. How can I not say the R word? But I said another R word. And I hadn't really realized it and I wasn't sensitive to it and somebody called me out on it. Now, at that moment, you can get your back up and decide you know everything in the world, or you can step back and go, that's important to someone. And I think that's where we got to learn, is just because it's not important to us, it may be important to someone else.
And another good example in the sports world is the Washington Redskins.
Right.
And the white world just can't fathom that that might be important to someone else. And who cares, white world, if it's not important to you? And
honest
you don't understand
God.
That that's a bad yeah. word, Redskins. It's a bad word to someone.
Right.
It's demeaning to them.
Right.
Just be conscious of the things that aren't necessarily important to you, but are important to someone else, and let what they feel is important teach you that you're being insensitive to their importance. And I learned a big lesson yesterday, and it wasn't easy.
I used the word in the past few months, a couple words I used that I used the word lame. That's really lame. Okay, no. That's not appropriate, and I was called down on it, and I thanked
what
people
is it,
for
it. I don't know it either. What is wrong with the word lame?
Well, the,
ableism.
You can't, it's a word like you cannot walk or something. I mean, it's making okay.
Okay.
And the other one I did.
Right.
Okay, and the other one I did was I said circle the wagons.
Right.
Which
right.
is like, what in the heck? You know, of course that is a derogatory. So sensitive, and I'm saying these things that are offending people, but thank God people believe that I'll listen to them, and so I'm able to learn and adapt and change and do it in front of people, and they can see that if, you know, it's not the mistake you make, that's understandable. It's whether or not you're willing to adapt to people.
Absolutely. I said, listen, you know, he didn't understand. He was thinking a different word. And you right away said, no. Don't make excuses. I own it. I said it. I understand. I'll do better. That's
like,
it.
Don't try to protect me or provide cover for me. I made a mistake. Let me own it.
Yeah.
But that's terrific.
Let me apologize for
that's
it.
Terrific.
Let me move forward as a better man. And then the thing is, the beauty of the world, and people don't talk about it enough. We're talking about somebody who pointed it out named Holly Golightly, who I've never met. I've never seen her face. She's just a symbol. I don't even know where she lives. But the weird thing about the world and the wonderful thing about it is if somebody points out something like that and you behave like a man and take it and try to grow, she ended up finishing that segment saying, or that little exchange saying that she was crying. She was so moved that somebody would allow her because it was important to her. For whatever historical reason that she has, that somebody would respond like that. And then there were two or three additional people that jumped in at that moment, and they credited all of us for having a civil discussion because they're so not used to it.
Mm.
And
that's how
movements grow. That's how great things grow. That's how friendships grow. That's how love grows. And I think that the way that Holly felt that she needed to say it, and I reacted well, and we communicated with each other and grew out of that moment, and we're better people for it. I'm sure there's a friendship there now that wasn't there before.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of the world. And that's what we can all do. And if we start doing that more and more. And that's why I think social media, as difficult as it can be sometimes, because the trolls are just so hellish. Mm. It's a beautiful thing, too. It's a beautiful thing. I think a boycott has a chance for success post-Ferguson announcement better than any other time in history because of social media.
Sure.
To pass that information of what companies have behaved poorly and go instead to a company that also sells that product, and they behaved well, and double the bonus if they're African-American companies. The growth out of that, I mean, I think we can do great things. I think we can, but we have a long way to go.
Well, and Amy, you said it in the beginning that, you know, just listen, you know, don't try to interject, and if you do, and we're trying to learn, it's an evolution, we're growing, we're going to make mistakes. When we do, acknowledge, own it, and vow to do better. That's all you can do. And when you know better, you do better. And I would say that, you know, my wife and other people of color I've interacted with, honestly, for white people, just simply listening and believing people of color's testimony when they tell you this is happening. Just start right there. Listen and believe what they're telling you. That goes an awful long way.
Amy, then, because I think Drew's onto something here, and you would have a great say on it because you seem to really, really understand this. But how do we stop that instinctive first reaction? Everybody in the world, I mean, I guess it's natural in the human condition to have this instinctive first reaction when you're told something to get your back up. That sort of fight or flight reaction instead of, hey, it's time to learn. Why can't we instinctively say to ourselves, hey, I made a mistake, or somebody's trying to teach me something, or somebody's trying to open my eyes to something that I may not know because it's not my experience. Why do we as people not open ourselves up to that better?
Well, I
how
think
do we?
You need to remember, first of all, that at any point you can bail out. You know, no matter how far you've gone down this point of like fighting back against this feedback, you can say, wait, whoa, okay, I'm now listening.
Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
You know,
I see. You can always say, I see.
Yeah, you can always stop. And even if you've like made a career out of trying to deny that circling the wagons isn't defensive and shouldn't be offensive and you're too sensitive, as soon as you start hearing yourself kind of saying those things, just remember, are you a member of that group?
Right.
No. Well, no, I'm not an indigenous person. I'm not a Native American. So I don't get to make that call. They do. You know, and as soon as you kind of come to terms with that, just stop.
And that was the whole thing about Piers Morgan, right? Here's
yes,
a white guy,
exactly.
And it's all respectability politics. And when he says, don't use the N-word, I'm hearing the same thing other people say. Well, I wish they'd pick up their pants and stop listening to rap music. All that trope crap is the same. But here's a white guy telling people of color what they need to do to stop us white people from fucking killing them. You know, how
so
crazy is that? That is totally crazy.
Yeah,
it's absolutely nuts.
Totally crazy. And because, and you know, another way that you can really grow, I found, I mean, I always talk about walking in the shoes. Another way is to just reverse it. Just reverse it. I mean, whenever you ask somebody to reverse it, they'll go, wow. I mean, can you imagine someone telling Piers Morgan what word he needed to learn how to use better if they were black? You imagine that?
Well,
he'd go crazy. He'd go crazy. It's like, well, are you kidding me? How dare you talk to me that way? I mean, he'd go nuts.
Well, kind of, but we also need to remember as white people, since we have the power, right? We've got this, we're at the top of the food chain, that we aren't going to experience that same sense of the stack of deck, you know, the card deck being stacked against us. So it's hard. As white people, we don't have anything really to compare to. We haven't experienced that, and we need to be. That's why we need to listen.
I'll take it a step further.
Can I give me another example? Let's say that flag I talked about. Let's say there was a white who was holding the Confederate flag, and a black took that flag away. I mean, there are just so many scenarios that are so not seen because of white supremacy, because of white privilege, that if you actually put yourself in a role reversal, it's almost a way to open your eyes that white privilege is more ridiculous than you even imagined, because the roles would never reverse.
What you just said is the essence of white privilege, the fact that we white people can live our entire lives without ever having to, wanting to, or needing to think about the other. In converse, you're doing this reverse, flip things around. People of color live their entire lives first thinking about how they interact and then how they interact with the white world.
Absolutely.
They have to do it every day, every
minute. Night, sort of a couple nights ago, I had a white privilege night, and it was just fantastic. So, somebody wrote something to the effect of white privilege is sitting on a plane as a black person and wishing beyond wish that the person beside you that sits there won't be a racist. And we don't even know that world. And we're not even, I mean, we're just so privileged.
Yeah.
And we can't even imagine that someone will just sit down on a plane and say, God, I hope a nice person sits beside me. I hope a racist doesn't sit beside me. I hope this is a peaceful flight. I hope I can just have a nice flight.
To kind of toss in along those lines, too, I've been watching a lot of Jane Elliott's videos. I put in a link for you on that. But Jane Elliott did the blue eye, brown eye experiment.
Right.
She did this because as white people, we don't know what racism is like. We never will. You know, we're the top of the food chain. We're the ones who are discriminating against. The system is set up for us. So she did this blue eyes, brown eyes experiment after Martin Luther King was killed, because she knew the systemic racism was so difficult for white people to see. She wanted to make it visible. She wanted us to live it. And so if people could take a chance, you know, the first thing as a white person, if you want to understand, is to come to terms with this, that racism is a real thing. You know, you can't see it very well because it's just threaded through the fabric of our culture. It's just teeny little threads everywhere. But Jane Elliott helps make that visible with this experiment. And it's interesting seeing people from children up to adults, different cultures in the UK and the US, for example, experience this firsthand. And people would walk out of the room crying. I mean, we're talking about a half an hour of this pressure, right? That people who are not white live with every day. That we are not used to being discriminated against constantly. Mm-hmm. We are not used to this irrational, you know, the rules that are never going to work for us.
Yeah, and you know, the hashtag and Twitter does a really good job with this. So the Keen Pumpkin Fest, If They Gun Me Down, Pointer Gate, and Drumbeat, Your Violence Will Not Be Tolerated.
That's another perfect example, isn't it? This incredible white privilege of turning over cars, being extremely violent, and, you know, this is just kids blowing off steam, no problem. And then conversely, you have a protest that's not violent at all, and
well,
the military's out by the thousands.
Yeah.
They carried a pumpkin in there and were arrested.
For carrying a pumpkin. And no, I know Jumbie's...
Yeah, meanwhile, somebody rolled an apple and got arrested. You know, it's just... there was a tweet the other day that I read from an African-American who said that he was tired of feeling like he always had to move either off the sidewalk or change his path when someone of white came and walked the other direction.
Do you have to get going, Drumbeats? I know that you had a time constraint.
No, we're okay for now.
Okay. So I wanted to share, and Amy brought this, and I had seen one half of this, but so in that same context of you know, just institutionalized cultural racism, and a good example that shows it really just in its face amazingly. So there was two stories, and the one you know more about, so I'll let you talk about that in a minute. But so the first one I talked on our podcast maybe 2 weeks ago, there was a woman in a classroom in Camden, but it wasn't New Jersey. I made a mistake. It was Camden, New Jersey. It was Camden somewhere else, but North Carolina. And the woman said in response to a question about if she had 10 days to live, so sort of this like kind of like a bucket list, that she would kill all black people. If she had 10 days to live for her pleasure, she would kill all black people. This is a white woman that said that in a classroom. Some of the students obviously told parents. Parents got upset. Teacher gets suspended.
2 days.
2 days is back in the classroom, okay? And I want to make sure that we're really clear on this. This notion that she has 10 days to live and she wants to kill all the black people doesn't mean that she wants to have no black people in her life those last 10 days. It literally means that she's deriving some sort of pleasure out of it. It's like a sociopath. She wants to kill all these. And she said it. I'll kill all black people.
There's no consequence. She would not go to trial.
Nope. 2 days.
You get 10 days of pick the most important things you've ever wanted to do without consequence.
And that's her.
Kill all the black people.
That was the first thing she came to her mind, too, right? You know? Like that was on the tip of her tongue.
It's almost appropriate because I've been arguing, and Sean King, who we all know very well, he's fantastic, has been arguing, and they even went to school and did, I think, a dissertation on it, that basically racism is a pathology. It's a psychotic pathology. And
one thing for a person to say that, one out of, you know, how many billions of people in the world to say something like that, but it's, you know, but she got 2 days of suspension.
So let's do the other side. Let's do the other side.
23 years for the dog.
Well, no, we've got this is a perfect example. So a white woman, I want to kill all black people. 2 day suspension. So now, Amy, tell us about the teacher in Texas.
Right. So this past weekend, a woman that I followed on Twitter, and she followed me on Twitter, Duck Season 4, I think is was her handle. She doesn't have a real name on there. She made a comment. And I don't know if we
can read it. Not say, okay. Who the fuck made you dumb duck crackers think I give a squat fuck about your opinions on my opinions on Ferguson. Kill yourself. And I just want to make it clear, the phrase at the end, kill yourself, is sort of what gets you in trouble. It's a part of the black vernacular. It's Kevin Hart. It's a comedy routine. So she's, you know, expressing anger on social media, not in the classroom in front of her students, not saying I'm going to kill all black people.
Not even under her name.
Not even under her name. And what happened?
And a group of white women, conservatives, if you look at their profiles, it's really sad. I mean, because I wish that hateful people would let go of God, right?
Yeah.
All of these people are claimed to be Christian people, patriots. They've got the flag going. You know, they care about our children, that kind of thing. They identified her person, her real person. They outed her. They outed her phone number. They outed her boss's name. They outed the school she worked for. They outed the Twitter ID of her boss. And by the time Monday rolled around, what did you say? She was in the office at 7 o'clock? Is that what that article said?
Let me see.
Talking to the superintendent. And she's now suspended, awaiting the school board to fire her from her job. And I happened to see the video of the woman, the superintendent, district superintendent, talking about how we can, you know, a white woman, beautiful white woman, blonde hair, very ivory skin, talking about how we cannot tolerate this kind of thing, right? These kinds of people being around our children.
This is depressing.
It's
now,
ridiculous.
If you are paying attention at all to the to people like DeRay or people like Wise Chef or people like Nettie and looking at their mentions on Twitter, the ugliness of the troll comments, you know, it's this woman here is not talking to anyone. She's not directing her comments at anyone. She's just in broadly saying.
Yeah, so there was no ad.
This is first. There's no ad.
No, there's no ad at all. No ad.
There was no ad. She wasn't attacking anyone, and she was just generally speaking.
Nettie and DeRay, kill yourself. We don't need you. You're spreading race, you know, all of it. And so I think that, you know, just looking at these two teachers, we got one who wants to kill all the black people, and she's got 2 days off.
Yep.
Without pay. And then this woman who just is very frustrated by this negativity that we see every day, this racism, this hate, this lack of concern for black life, expressing her rage. And she's very likely going to be fired.
Drummed out of office. Drummed out of her position.
Publicly exposed.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing you said
that... We have to do a much better job of calling each other out. We're terrible.
I spent my whole weekend calling these people out, and they are proud. They were high-fiving each
other. Oh, that makes me sick.
I don't even mean Twitter. I mean just our daily lives. We got to call people each other out more.
Well,
not just for gigantic things, but little things. I feel like I might fight my entire day if I did it, but it'd still be worth it. I mean,
they're so blind.
Exactly. That's how you open the eyes.
They are not.
Hey, that little microaggression you made.
Some of these people are not. They think they're right.
Here's a good example. A.K.A. Charles Wade is the ad, and he was on our show, and he said he was at the airport. He was going from Austin to Ferguson before heading off to Geneva. And so he bought these two pack of peanuts, and the airport prices are lousy, right? And each one was $7, and he wanted both for $14. So he shows up, and he's got two, and he gets this microaggression, he says, from the teller saying, oh, like, did you want both of those? Because they're $7 each, you know. Like, sort of looking at him like, well, surely you don't have the money for these. You're black. You probably only got the money for one. And, you know, Charles Wade was like, yes, I want both of those. Thank you. I know how much they cost. I can figure it out, and I can add it up. You know, it's these microaggressions that happen all day long. These are the start. I mean, we just open each other's eyes with these microaggressions. Maybe the big things wouldn't even come into the minds that you're able to do them without punishment. Society's punishment.
Well, that's a good segue, because we did have on this episode, and we've got, I guess, we'll go a little long. Want to talk about how people can talk up, right? So I personally had this happen.
And this will be a nice finish, because I'd like to finish on a positive.
Well, I hope it is. But
depressing at times.
So,
those examples, Amy, were just terrible.
And the again,
terrible. I mean, I just...
I came to spread truth.
I vacillate between energized and wanting to do something and
we got to see it for what it is.
Feeling that it's
folks.
So important to just getting depressed.
Yeah. Well, so I have
go ahead, Drew.
I have another segment from Ian Haney Lopez, again, talking about dog whistle politics and how they stymie conversations.
I'm just going to. There's a lot of people who are ready for that message. So, in that sense, what's really necessary, let me back up and do it this way. Why don't liberals talk about race? What is it about present racial discourse that keeps liberals from talking about race? Let me tell you how present racial discourse works. It works through what I call the punch, parry, and kick of dog whistle politics. The punch, dog whistle terms that constantly punch racial insinuations into the conversation, right? Mm-hmm. Obama is the best food stamp president in history. Mm-hmm. The parry, since I didn't use a racial slur or directly reference race, I can't be racist. Right. This is a Gingrich. It's just a fact. The kick. Since you, liberal critic, just said the word race, you're the racist.
Right.
Stop playing the race card. Right? So I have to say. So.
And I know all three of us. I know all three of us have had that happen at least once in the last couple of days. You know, you're playing the race card.
It's usually in the last hour.
Yeah. But that's what happens, right? So there's this stymieing, and I tweeted about it, and I'll just let you guys talk in a minute. But I went to church, my liberal, progressive, Unitarian, Universalist church, for a visioning summit on social justice. We have 50 white people talking about what is the vision of our church from a social justice standpoint. And a guy stood up and said, I am sick of everyone talking about race and making this about racism. If you look at everything through the eyes of racism, you'll see racism everywhere. And we were all kind of stunned. And we have a right relations. We're supposed to speak in a certain way to each other. I simply told him how it made me feel. I said that, you know, I take offense to that. I think that's hurtful. It hurt my heart. You know, I'm very saddened that you would make that statement. And I thought maybe I should have lashed out more. I should have said, you know, stop the meeting. Is there anyone who thinks like this person? What's going on? And I had a couple people afterwards say, you know, again, there's a little bit of a white privilege thing, but they said, your ability to not lash out at him taught us a lot, right? So you're leaving. I ended up leaving the summit. I said, just if this is how this guy thinks, I'm not going to participate. And that was a statement on its own. But so a lot of people kind of, they woke up a little bit, and we're actually having an emergency meeting, a dialogue tomorrow, and I'm preparing what I'm going to say. There's a facilitator, and the stove is hot, right? So people at my community they kind of get it. My wife is black. We've left the church. We're having these issues. And we've even started with UUism, Unitarian Universalism, has a bit of a problem. We're a homogenous, white, privileged, educated, you know, middle, upper class group of people, and we invariably think, well, we participated in, you know, we're not overtly racist. We helped in Selma and Greensboro, and we you know, one of ours got killed, and we worked for civil rights, and you know, now we're baby boomers, and we're kind of done with that. We don't want to talk about it. It's uncomfortable. And I had another person that I respect greatly, a friend of mine, say, you're doing it wrong. I'm not listening to you because you're telling me you need to ask me questions. Oh, really, great white person. In order to understand racism, I have to get your opinion on how I should disseminate this information to you. So it's all kind of twisted and fucked up, and I don't have the answer. So I'm going to go. So part of my covenant with the congregation is that, like we've talked about here, we strive to be this ideal, and we're human, and we know we're going to fail. And when we do, please stay in a dialogue with us. You know, we encourage you to do this. And I've taken that covenant, so I'm going to stay in a dialogue with them. My wife is nowhere near it, and I wouldn't ask her to. That would be like, I feel like that's abuse, right? Like you're talking about microaggression. That'd be physical aggression, making her go talk to these well-to-do white folks about their privilege. But I don't know the answer. And that's why I asked earlier, can you do something bold and dramatic and overt? Does it have to be on white people's terms in order for them to get it, to empathize? And I struggle. I don't know what the answer is. And I'm going to go to church, and I'm going to see what they say and how it goes. But I guess, you know, Amy, I love that you're adamant and you know. Tell me more about why you think that is. And I don't disavow you of that.
Well, it's not a positive. We're going to end on a positive note, I thought. But, you know, sometimes people don't get it. And you can't compromise so that they're happy, because then you're perpetuating this system. So, you know, DeRay said, sit in your discomfort. Mm-hmm. And I keep repeating that to myself. And I think you said, the mountain is high.
Yep.
So we just have to remember that sometimes you're going to be alone.
Mm.
You know, and I think in a way, I feel good about those moments because I'm able to experience a little bit, a tiny little bit of what this has been like for other people. But I don't think you can make someone see it. And I don't think there's a way to package it so it's palatable. And those who are saying, sell it to me, don't want to hear it. And we have to accept that.
Mm. That isn't a positive.
No, it's not a positive.
That's okay. What about you, Drumbeats? I know you're a man of faith.
I am. Yeah, I I'm trying. And, you know, and one of the ways that has been difficult is that it seems as if anybody who's Christian and involved in this issue seems to have completely forgotten Christ. So that's been a tricky part about all of this is you want to see that faith is directed in some very basic tenets that Christianity revolves around, and love thy neighbor is one, and pass no judgment on another. Judgment is mine, is another, and mine is the Lord's, and vengeance is mine, is the Lord's. And that if you love one another as I have loved you, then you shall know the kingdom of heaven. And so there's not a lot of those principles that I'm seeing daily from those that profess to believe. So it's been challenging, for sure. Twitter, just every single time that I look, and it seems like the worst person on their bio is Christian.
Right.
Not the best person. And
well, who did Christ get along with?
He turned over the tables in the temple for one
exactly.
thing. I mean, he sacrificed and he loved and
he didn't get along with the religious people, right? You
know,
he didn't get along with the religious people.
No, not at all.
Of his
no,
day, the Pharisees
started his
and
own
the Sadducees.
One, in other words, but
yeah.
I mean, the point of Christianity is to live a life as Christ. And one of the very famous things that certainly in the last 10 years that became extremely popular, and it's not so much now, but it was in the past, was what would Jesus do? And I hope for God's sakes nobody sits there and says what would Jesus do as a bumper sticker or as a faith moment in their lives and announce to themselves that they would, you know, do what they're doing.
Yeah, you
know,
said in our first podcast, it's not your Jesus.
Say, what would Jesus do? And then say, well, Jesus would, you know.
They do. They say it.
Blur, or
let's
Jesus
be honest.
Would have my privilege, or Jesus would kill this young boy, or Jesus would think that unarmed man deserved to die, or that Jesus would want thousands of military to roll up on defensive people in the next 3-4 days in Ferguson. I mean, if you're answering what would Jesus do and any of this makes sense, I don't think it's Jesus you love but yourself. So you better regroup.
Yeah.
You better regroup if you're on that side because, as DeRay says, and I agree when he says it, I'm on the side of justice and I have no confusion about that.
Yeah, and unflappably, you know, I think that's – and there's a couple of good resources. We talked about, you know, how to speak out. There's a great Tumblr called Racism School 101, and I'll put it in the show notes. And the individual that runs it, I don't know his name. He's not as active on Twitter, but has a 5 uneasy steps that allies can make, and it's really great. And there's a few things he talks about, and one of them is sort of as your evolution of becoming – this is an ally apprentice, and then you're really – and I don't love the word ally. I think that's – inappropriately self-anointed sometimes, but you know, if you truly want to be an ally, you've got to speak out about this stuff every time. There is no pass. There is no way he meant it this way. He didn't mean it that. And there's, you know, there's some exceptions. Maybe it's your family. There's a situation where it's dangerous for you physically, but in general, all the time, every time, you got to speak up about this stuff. And I think we're going long. And I just want to maybe make a comment. And I'm not trying to proselytize. I am a UU. I do think our faith is struggling with this issue. We're predominantly privileged, and we're not addressing this adequately. And one of the great things about Unitarian Universalism is that we're a democracy, and that as a congregation, we can decide and do whatever we want as we get a quorum. We have enough people. We can, you know, rally the troops and do what we need to do. And so we took a different approach. The governing body, the UUA, was not doing what we thought was appropriate. So my wife formed her own Facebook group, RUU Awake, and she's formed a PAC, a political action committee, with the sole purpose to, within the Unitarian Universalist Church, to form and address the issues related to racial injustice and privilege within our own faith and our own pews. And it's, I think it's just brilliant. And looking at it from, rather than what are we going to do, how hard is this, this is difficult. Boy, Jumbie, what's your dog's name? I'll tell him to calm down. She made this pack, and this is, we're going to increase awareness within our churches and our congregations regarding privilege, racism, and justice. We're going to schedule and hold racism jubilee training every district, every year, with full ministerial support. And we're going to hold the UUA accountable, and then they're going to provide swift and concrete support for racial justice movements and activities in this country. And then we have principles, and we've got seven of them, but the number one is the inherent dignity and worth of all people. We're going to ask to have an eighth principle added. And I think, just again, looking at this as a political action from our own church as a microcosm, I think there's a larger sort of, you know, think outside the box. It's not just being on Twitter and hashtag. It's not just speaking up. But we need to start thinking. We need to get organized and coordinated about this kind of stuff, because the other side is, you know, supremacy has been organized and coordinated and doing this to us for forever. They're real friggin' good at it. We've got to kind of, you know, I don't say we, I mean white people. We've got to start figuring out how to speak up about this, how to have these conversations, these dialogues, how to make this change, you know, because it's just people are dying, right? Just, we have to. It's time. It's way over time.
It's five o'clock.
Yep, absolutely.
Totally agree.
Life is calling me.
No problem, Drumbeats. I tell you what, why don't we let you go, and then Amy and I will take just a minute to do our outro and sign off. But Drumbeats, okay, as always, appreciate it, and we'll talk to you again next Wednesday.
Amy, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Okay. Appreciate being on the show. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll see you next Wednesday.
Okay.
Okay.
Amy, if you want to, I do really appreciate you being here, and I think you've brought a lot of really great stuff. And we didn't get to everything. We had a few things we wanted to talk about, we didn't. But love the story with the two teachers. Again, that juxtaposition is, it's just so obvious when you see it, and it's right there for us to do it. I fully in agreement, sort of, with your listen and learn. What other, you know, maybe tips or tools do you have that you wanted to share with us before we sign off?
I think read up on white privilege if you're not familiar with it. That's a really good place to start, because it's not what a lot of people think. There's just all this, should I feel guilty about being white? No. You know, white privilege is just understanding that things are made better or easier for you on behalf by other people, or at the expense of other people. And there's a lot of good resources out there. You can just Google white privilege and find a ton of really good things. And that, I think, starts to open your eyes. So just become aware of your privilege. And then, you know, expand your involvement beyond just white people somehow. You know, get involved with the broader, more diverse world. And then listen. You know, learn to listen. And if you have an iPhone, I think I've told this to my kids and people in my community, have it ready. You know, if you see police with pulling over black people or encountering black people, you might want to be videotaping that at this point.
Yeah. And in fact, Charles Wade made a good comment to not only videotape, but also, get in there. You know, that white observers are plenty. We observe it all the time, and we don't film it. Not only film it, but ask the questions. Why are you detaining me? What's going on? Because that's where our privilege, you know, we're not going to get we're not going to get shot and killed. We know that. We can go in.
We might even let them go if a white person says something, which is really, really sad.
It is. It's terrible, but it's probably true.
Right.
I spoke on one of my podcasts maybe earlier in the month where I had that very incident. I got up and started filming something. The cop knocked the camera out of my hands. No, I asked all the questions, and it just left me with such a horrible taste. But someone that was there said, well, you know, thank you. I wish you'd been here when I got pulled over. And just, you know, being open and honest and saying, hey, this is not right, and I don't think it's right, rather than silent. We've been silent for a long time, and guess what? It's not working. People are dying.
Speak in your community. Speak around you like you are at your church. And I wanted to throw in, too, that, you know, I heard about your weekend experiences. I could tell how down you felt about it, how much you cared about these relationships. And I put out on Twitter that, you know, a lot of people have been expressing, you know, challenges that they're facing in their friendships because of what the last 90 days have brought. And so many people responded to me about friendships lost, about family issues, you know, and a pastor, a woman, spoke about a church she's now in trouble with because of a sermon she gave last Sunday. So understand you're not alone. We're going through a change as a world right now. And find comfort in other people and their experiences, because a lot of people are working hard to bring these changes, and they're paying for it. And I think there's some comfort in that too.
Yeah.
So
and
seek those people out.
And I love social media about that. You know, I've made great connections specifically around, you know, Ferguson and what's going on with people like you and Drumbeats and a lot of other folks. But I will say, you mentioned, you know, in your community. So Leslie Mack, my wife, started a Tumblr. It's FergusonResponse.tumblr.com. And there's about, I think, 40 or 50 different cities listed. And there's a submission form. So you can find a city where there's action. And the action is specifically planned for the day the grand jury announcement is made or the day after. So look at the city, see the, if it's either – so there's not a date. It won't say a date because we don't know when the announcement's going to happen. But we want to be prepared, and it'll say where you're going to meet, what time you're going to meet, what to wear in terms of you know, solidarity and uniformity. And is, you know, there's about, I think, 45, 47 different cities already.
Amazing.
And if you want to have an event, if you want to – you know, if you're a church and you want to just have a candlelight vigil, you want to do something. There is going to be pain, and people need and want to express it, and these actions can wake up more people. Please submit your information to that form. She's working diligently, gets it up probably, you know, updated every couple hours. But so that's FergusonResponse.tumblr.com, and that's got a list of planned responses around the country after the Darren Wilson grand jury announcement. And I should say, I don't have a lot of hope, but maybe it's the right announcement, and that turns into a celebration. That would be a lovely thing. But there's an event surrounding that. And I will put some more links, but you mentioned the white privilege. I don't know if you referenced the invisible backpack, but that's McIntosh. I think it was Peggy McIntosh wrote it in the 80s. And that's probably the first thing I read that opened my eyes to white privilege. So Unpacking the Invisible Backpack will include that. I think there's another article I saw it in the Washington Post called Explaining White Privilege to a Broke White Person. And I've shared that with some folks and found that really valuable. I think the next sort of step is learning more about our history, understanding, you know, what some of the you know, dog whistle politics, understanding, you know, sort of the FHA sanctioned redlining and what we've done. Ta-Nehisi Coates' article, The Case for Reparations, is also fantastic in that regard.
That's a good piece,
He wrote another one about white supremacy. So I'll put all these links underneath the podcast, because I think they're great resources. And I don't know our audience, so maybe people could tell us what you're looking for. But I assume most of the folks listening are kind of in alignment with the movement and social justice. So hopefully these links will be good for other people in your life. So it's not just for folks listening, but you know, let's share this and try to wake folks up. My mom, 70 plus years old, is sending Ta-Nehisi Coates' article to friends one at a time and inviting them over for tea at her house. I'm not even kidding. One at a time. You know, it's something.
Yeah.
She's doing something. So I've got a little outro, and I'll end on this. But did you want to have any sort of final words before we stop the recording, Amy?
Well, I just want to tell you thanks for having me on. I listening to you guys, it's good for my soul. It was good to find people that felt the same way and encouraging to me to continue to stay involved and help other white people awaken.
Wow.
So.
Well,
thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. And that's an excellent segue to my – I'm going to end with this. I think each of these white privilege podcasts, because they're words I'm trying to really sort of live by and take solace in. One person can change the world. Love with no limits. Feel everything. Our intensity is not a fault but a superpower. Help, don't hinder. Support, don't supplant. Cooperate, don't co-opt. Solidarity, not charity. Reveal, don't conceal our truth. And with that, we'll end the White Privilege Podcast. But Amy, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
In absentia, thank you, Drumbeats. Everyone, we'll talk to you next Wednesday.